think this time I'll do a podcast.
Welcome to the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Ben Heisler.
All right, everybody, welcome in. This is episode 2 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. Ben Heisler here, alongside with Andrew Buckholz, Ken Fang, and Matt Yoder. Gentlemen, it is good to have you back. This is going to be a fun show today. A lot going on our roundtable. Also, make sure you stick around because Ben Koo sits down with ESPN college football analyst Kirk Herbstreit, really the face of college football, I think, of the modern generation. And they're both Buckeyes, so hopefully Ben doesn't just completely go off the rails for that, but I heard it. I know he does. He does a great job. But excited to hear that conversation for you guys a little bit on later. Gentlemen, we've had another very interesting last couple of weeks, and I feel like it's best for us to get started with all the conversation surrounding the national anthem, because I think it's important before we move forward here that it is not a controversy on the national anthem. It is a controversy, and it is a statement, a political statement on racial inequality. It is a political statement on social injustice. And it just so happens that the national anthem, as a result of it, has sort of brought its way into the mix. So, Andrew, I'll start with you. What surprised you the most and how this whole controversy eventually came together and just the legs eventually that it started to stand on?
Yeah, I mean, I think this controversy has particularly gotten interesting and gone to another level in the past couple of weeks because of President Donald Trump's comments on it on Twitter. And I think that's really made it much more of a mainstream discussion as opposed to a discussion amongst a few NFL fans and a lot of sports media people. I mean, something that's really interesting about this whole thing is that when it started, a lot of people didn't know for weeks because broadcasters don't usually show the national anthems. And that's changed a little bit. The broadcasters have all sort of commented on, well, we'll show it. We'll show it if it's relevant, or we'll show clips of it later. But I mean, national anthem is usually a prime commercial break for NFL broadcasters. And so this has been it started as a very limited controversy with Colin Kaepernick and a couple of teammates. It's blown into a whole national media dialogue. And I feel that the president's tweets really helped make a big deal there. And they did in quite an interesting way, because a lot of people on the left were saying, oh, well, we're going to boycott the NFL because they're not employing Colin Kaepernick. And all of a sudden, the NFL is now sort of the good guys for some of those people because of these the resistance to Trump's tweets, because of some owners even sticking up for their players. So it's fascinating to me that what started off in such a small way and started off with one guy has now become a national political debate. And I feel that the president's tweets really did that.
Yeah, it's similar to me. And it's striking. Our first podcast 2 weeks ago, we talked about Jemele Hill and ESPN, right, and Travis and everything like that. To me, there's a very striking similarity in this story. And that is that it caught on like wildfire thanks to a rant from the sitting president of the United States. I mean, when you look at Colin Kaepernick, it was easy, I think, to kind of pinpoint all this on him when you were looking at him taking a knee for the national anthem. All of a sudden, President Trump shines a light on it, and you have entire teams not coming out for it. You have more players taking a knee. You have it dominating the news cycle for weeks at a time now. And when you go back to it, what does it all originate from? And it's really that rally in Alabama and those derogatory statements that he made. And then all of a sudden it becomes this huge political debate and it gets taken up to a whole nother level. So to me, it was striking that you could really trace some of the fundamentals of the story back to Jemele Hill and all the attention and the controversy and the debate there. And that they've all been stoked by this raging political fire that seems to be consuming every single thing in society these days. But Ben, you know, I think you said it all in your intro. We have made this story about the anthem. The media, Twitter, president, everyone has made this about the anthem. That's not what it was originally about. Originally, it was about Colin Kaepernick taking a knee for social injustice, for police brutality. And I think the more we get away from that, the more I kind of wonder what is the end game and where is this all going to go? Because now you kind of see that owners, the league, everyone's kind of taken the show of quote unquote unity.
Right.
Well, what does that exactly mean now? And where do we go from here?
What do you think it means, Ken?
I'm just amazed, guys, about how much legs that this has really grown. The story has really grown the legs for the story. And, you know, you both touched on it. The fact is that I'm just amazed that someone like a Shannon Sharpe becomes the voice of reason undisputed in talking about how NFL owners now have been hurt and hit by President Trump. And now they don't want to be told what to do by the president. And therefore they're going to come about and hit back. So again, yes, we've totally lost what the whole original kneeling was all about. And the fact is that President Trump has started to own the story a little bit, and we've kind of lost the whole original idea of it. But again, as long as the networks feel that this is a story, and Fox tried to ignore it in the last Sunday by not showing it. But again, CBS has shown it. We saw NBC show it this last weekend. ESPN showed it also on their game in Kansas City and Washington. So it's going to be a story for as long as the networks feel it has to run. And it'll be interesting to see how Fox decides to handle it, and if they decide to show the national anthem this coming Sunday. I'm interested. And now it's become a fact that, are they going to show it? Aren't they going to show it?
Right.
Who's going to show it? And, you know, how long are they going to be showing it?
I want to go back to something that Matt said, which I also find to be fascinating, and that it almost allowed Roger Goodell in the NFL to come across in a very favorable public relations light. I mean, you had the cover of Sports Illustrated with it's like Steph Curry holding on to a photoshopped Roger Goodell in the front row. And this whole idea of this was, you know, unity from the NFL. And you guys know that I love the Dan Le Batard show. And he talked about this on his show this week. Of course, the message of, well, we're all discussing the element of unity. Like, this is what the NFL is standing for. We are celebrating unity. Well, unity of what? And I feel like a lot of those messages and what the players were ultimately trying to convey, and even Jerry Jones pulling us on the jig as well for all of it, they're just watching that message come together for not necessarily even having a message, but it was about the NFL was standing together. That sort of became the message that was conveyed through all of this after sorting through all the BS.
Who would have had in your office pool Roger Goodell as the face of American unity? I mean, the only thing more ridiculous than that is electing a reality TV star president of the United States. I think this comes in a close second, but that's kind of where this story has gone. And it's just so weird to me how we so easily do this as a society. And to me, going forward now, Ken kind of talked about, you know, what are the networks going to do from here? And I think that goes to what's going to happen with the protests during around the anthem. And does this become something that is more of a footnote, or does this become something that continues throughout the rest of the season? Because if the NFL, the teams, the owners come together and all say, well, you know, we're going to try to play it down the middle. We're not going to try to offend everybody. We're going to take a knee here and stand here and do this and do that. I just wonder, will this all kind of go away when people see there isn't necessarily one side or another that's going to register a win or a loss here in their perceived camps? And will the NFL, now that Goodell and everyone can celebrate standing for quote unquote unity, whatever that quote unquote means, will they kind of hope that this ends with Roger Goodell shining a great humanitarian light on himself and the shield? I don't know.
I'm just wondering if the Nobel Prize Committee is going to start nominating Roger Goodell as a potential Nobel Prize award-winning for the Nobel Peace Prize, because that's where it seems to be heading. Because it seems like north is south, south is west, east is northeast. We have no idea what direction this is going in, because the story is just seems to be so out of whack.
It's bewildering just how everything has gone in so many different directions. I am curious to know, because I think when it comes to ratings, you can certainly try and fashion a lot of the information in the direction that you want to take it. If you want to make it a local perspective, if you want to make it a national perspective, you certainly can. But how significant of a hit do you think this actually could be for the NFL? I think a lot of it is dependent on game flow. Week 3, when the ratings were up, despite the protests. You had some great games. That week three in the NFL, after some duds in week one and week two, week three was great. Week four had a little bit more up and down. But collectively, over the rest of the season, do we think this is going to have some sort of a significant hit with people saying that they're going to burn their season tickets? Which, you know, if you're really going to do that, just give it to kids. The kids would love to go to those games. But the people that truly say they're going to swear off the NFL, I mean, are we buying this? Do we actually think that we're going to see tangible numbers for this?
There are so many people that watch the NFL that I think it's really hard to say that this is going to have a tangible impact. And there's so many other factors. I mean, who's playing, what time they're playing, how close the game is, what major current events are happening in the world. That, to me, you look at these numbers, and we tried to rack our brains last year. You know, was it the election? Was it the news cycles? Was it this? Was it that? I think a lot of times we become prisoners of the moment, and we try to dictate what some trends are based on 1-2 weeks of numbers here and there. To me, the NFL is playing a longer term game, and we're not going to know the true impact for a couple of years at least. And I've always wondered, when is the NFL going to reach their ratings peak? I mean, we've seen them climb year after year after year, and maybe it's just attrition. Maybe it's there's too many games on in prime time. The NFL's tried to expand across the week too much with Thursday night football. I mean, couldn't we really say the NFL ratings are down because they're playing, you know, games on Thursday nights that aren't great football? Or are they down because, you know, guys are taking a knee during the national anthem? Are they down because there's a Republican in the White House or a Democrat? Are they down because it's cloudy in New York and sunny in LA? I mean, you could go on and on and on and on about these factors, but I think until you see longer term trends, it's impossible to say what the main reason reasons truly are.
Andrew, do you anticipate a significant hit for the NFL in due time with this?
Yeah, I don't think there really will be one. I think Matt made an excellent point that there's so many factors that go into NFL ratings. A lot of it, so much of it has to do with the media matchups. And we had some good pieces on that this past year of just how different the ratings are, whether you have the Dallas Cowboys or the Jacksonville Jaguars. And I feel that that was the case with last year, too, with a lot of people. I mean, the NFL is such a big thing. It's such a behemoth that people try to pin whatever storyline they want onto it. And I think we've seen that with some of this coverage. We've seen that with the likes of Sports Illustrated and that cover. There's a lot of people trying to make the NFL a compelling part of their narrative, but the ratings don't necessarily support whatever narrative you're forming with it. And there's all sorts of things that that affect NFL ratings. I think one of the most interesting results last year in when this stuff first started coming out was a lot of results found it's not any less people watching the NFL. It's the same amount of people watching it, but they were watching it for less time. And so to me, that shows that it's not a boycott. It's not necessarily politically motivated or anything. Maybe this some of this stuff turns people off a bit and gets them to consume a little bit less. But there are so many interconnected issues with the NFL, including concussions, including the fate of retired players, including these anthems, including just general questions about how entertaining the game is, especially compared to other alternatives like college football. I don't think you can really pinpoint this and say this is what's going to be a cause of lower ratings.
You know what's curious to me is you mentioned the concussion element to it, and maybe this is a conversation for another time. When that study and information was released from Boston University about the significance and the potential opportunity to diagnose CTE in living players, if that's ultimately going to be a successful test, that is where you're going to start to see in due time the NFL really start to worry, and football in general start to worry. When you can start finding out whether or not living players are dealing with CTE-type symptoms and actually truly diagnose it, that's going to be when the NFL really starts to worry, and when football programs in general are going to truly distance themselves Malcolm Gladwell has talked about this before, the idea of football eventually going the way of the military, where it becomes an ends to justify the means, where it's just, it's not going to be in the same realm as what it is before, because there's going to be too much information released. There's going to be too much factors for parents to say that I can't let my kid do that unless this is a dire situation. I think that's when you're going to start to see more and more people tend to move away from football. One other thing on the anthem that I want to get into with all of you guys, looking at it from sort of an outward angle towards everybody in viewership, towards personalities and people that have really sort of staked their claim. We talked about Shannon Sharpe a little bit earlier on in the show. And Ken, I'll start with you on this. Is there anybody in the media who, I guess if you look at their stock, whether it's gone up or down because of their commentary on this issue, who has stood out to you as somebody even in either a positive or a negative light that a lot of people are now talking about because they have fully ingrained themselves into this conversation?
Well, I mentioned Shannon Sharpe because I wrote the story on his rant the day after the original anthem protest in week three. And that's one that's really stood out because, you know, and usually we don't usually pay attention to Undisputed. We try not to, but his thoughts were really one that were decent and well thought out, believe it or not. And that one that sticks out to me. Also, I think Levitard has been quite good on this as well. I think he's been very good on this and quite level-headed. But there's just all of those rants that come from both sides, whether you listen to the left or you listen to the right. Those are the ones that are the extreme, and you really have to try to really use a funnel or try to use a strainer to try to get out that noise and try to get to the real message that you want to hear, because in between it's kind of difficult to find it because there's so many voices on both extremes.
Mine wasn't personal, but more corporate. I was really surprised to see Eric Shanks and Fox come out earlier in the week and say Fox isn't going to show the anthems this Sunday. I just think from a news perspective, from a journalism perspective, this is at the time at least, was the biggest story in sports that people were talking about. So for an entire network to say, we're going to go back to the commercials, that was really puzzling to me. Whether you agree with it or not, whether you think it's going to turn off viewers or not, this is something that everyone's talking about. And that's why I think it's going to be fascinating to watch to see, will these media companies, will the league, will these forces try to kind of stamp out the fires that have been started with this story, or will we see it evolve naturally and kind of kick up once again? So to me, that was the most surprising development that came out of this. As Ken mentioned, you saw the networks handle it in different ways, but I just think from a pure news story, basically saying, hey, this was just something we talked about for 1 week and then kind of moved on from, was really surprising.
Andrew, before I get to you, Matt, let me follow up really quick. Do you think that was in product by Fox, a decision where they just didn't have to put the pressure and the onus on their broadcasters to have to comment on it?
It's possible. I mean, it's hard to say really what the motivation might be. Maybe it is that sense of fatigue from the story and trying to get fans' minds off of it and say, hey, you're here because you like football and you want it as an escape from politics and society and everything.
Just one less angry letter to read, maybe.
Well, and maybe that's it. You know, I feel like this following on the Jemele Hill, Donald Trump stuff, the politicization from Clay Travis, and, you know, you have Fox News over everything. Maybe it's just a way of saying, look, we just want to take a step back and focus on football to a certain extent. But again, I just feel like it's such an important news story. When you see politics and sport and culture and sport and society and sport intersect in such a visceral way, it's 2017 and everything we talked about 2 weeks ago and everything that's happened in the world in the last 12 to 18 months, it's just not something you can't ignore anymore. And sure, we all long for those days when sports was an escape and you could forget about the troubles of the world. But I don't know, maybe that's just revisionist history and us looking with rose-colored glasses through history, because there have been activists, there have been sports crossing over into politics and vice versa throughout the decades and throughout the generations. So I think it's a bit of a false hope that we try to have and trying to say, you know, we can compartmentalize life into these different parts instead of accepting it all for what it is.
Andrew, was there anyone that had stood out to you with either a positive or negative commentary with regards to the anthem and with regards to this entire conversation?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we brought up Shannon Sharp earlier, and I think he really has had a lot of thoughtful commentary on this. And I would say Nick Wright as well, who we also discussed.
Yeah.
And those two guys are impressive to me because they weren't the most notable or the most prominent personalities at FS1 on a lot of these debate shows, but they're really turning out to have some thoughtful and some interesting takes. On the negative side, I think there have been a lot of people who have hurt themselves with their commentary on these issues. And I feel like Matt said, I think Fox is sort of hurting itself with Eric Shank's decisions not to really talk about this notable event. I think another interesting personality is Britt McHenry, the former ESPN person,
yeah,
who has now just become this regular Fox News guest. And not just regular Fox News guest, but she's bashing these protests and she's bashing everything in a way that doesn't seem particularly informed. I think what's interesting is that there have been a lot of people who have had smart, thoughtful critiques of ESPN, and I don't think Britt McHenry is one of them. Sports Illustrated, for me, also really took a hit with that cover and with the decision to show somebody like Roger Goodell and not Colin Kaepernick. And I think that was very indicative of where SI is at this point in time, and with them always trying to get people's attention, always trying to be just in the moment, whether it's with five regional covers or covers of whatever the flavor of the moment is. But I think they're sort of missing the point and missing the overall context. And to me, that cover was really emblematic of that.
I'm just surprised they didn't put a Kardashian on there just to try to be in the moment, Andrew. So you just never know with them.
If we're at the point where we'll give the Kardashians credit for something, then that's not a place that I want to be in. Besides the point. All right, but before we move on, and I'm glad somebody brought up FS1 because there is a good transition here. Katie Nolan is leaving, and we were trying to figure out for a while, like, okay, they have this really smart, progressive, creative thinker who maybe didn't necessarily have the ratings that they would have been looking for when Garbage Time first came out. But it was apparent that they were invested very early on in Katie Nolan from the very beginning. And this is somebody that they realized had star potential. And I guess the biggest question in all of this, and maybe we don't have an answer for it, is, to quote a Mighty Wind, hey, what happened? What happened with Katie Nolan at Fox, and where do you think it all went wrong?
This is one I can't really wrap my head around because, and just follow me on this one. So FS1 launches a few years ago, and they try to be the alternative to ESPN. New shows, new formats, new voices. Katie Nolan is one of the breakout stars, right? I mean, we all agree on that. She's very popular. A lot of people like her. I can't think of really very many people outside of the Awful Announcing comment section that really has a bad thing to say about Katie Nolan. I haven't read the comments in a long time, so I don't know if that's still the case, but who knows. And then all of a sudden, Jamie Horowitz comes, gets all of his guys in, Embrace Debate, all of that. And Katie Nolan, let's just face it, she loses her spot. She loses her spot in the FS1 lineup. So Horowitz gets ousted. All of that embarrassment happens. The FoxSports.com fiasco. He leaves. And instead of going back to the original personalities that put you on the map, instead of going back to finding your roots, finding your soul, being the alternative to ESPN, and going back to people like Katie Nolan, you just leave them basically high and dry. And you say, we just don't have anything for you. Sorry. I mean, there's only so much airtime when you have 20 hours a day of Skip Bayless, Colin Cowherd, Jason Whitlock, and their replays on the air. There's just no room in the schedule for you. And so she's basically going to walk to ESPN, it seems. And I just don't understand how a cable sports network who gives birth to this personality on a national scene, who is popular, who is well-liked, who seems to have everything going for her, suddenly has no role for her and is just going to let her walk to their biggest competitor.
Ken, were you surprised at how this unfolded for Katie Nolan?
Yeah, I am. And Matt is right about how the whole thing transpired because, it kind of reminds me of when NBC got Michelle Beadle and lured her away from ESPN to bring her over. they had this big thing, and they said that she's going to do a lot of things, and then they realized they had nothing to really to do. And then, of course, she spoke out about it too. That didn't help her at all as well. But the fact is that
there's an oral history to be written, I think, about the crossover with Michelle. Who was the guy? What, Dave Briggs or someone?
Dave Briggs. Yeah.
There's got to be an oral history there, I think, with what went down at the crossover.
It'll be a short story.
Well, that's true.
I know that she's told me privately about a few things. One day I will try to get her to say a few things about that. But it really didn't go well between those two. If we could get a 30 for 30 on Jimmy the Greek, we should definitely get a 30 for 30 on the crossover, on how that whole thing went down.
What if I told you that there is a show that nobody wanted to watch?
with two combatant personalities who just didn't get along. But getting back to Katie Nolan, I think there was a little parallel between her and Michelle Beadle, because the FS1 thought they had a very good personality here, but then after Jamie Horowitz came in, they just really didn't know what to do with her. They tried to put her as a late night personality with Garbage Time. They also put her on NFL Films Presents, and they didn't promote her on the fact, and she's still going to be on the show, as a matter of fact, while she's let out early of that contract. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens here. She's probably going to be, I mean, the fact that FS1 is going to allow her to basically walk over to ESPN and hand her on a silver platter where she can be utilized in the way that they want to utilize her. I think this is a bad move by Fox Sports, and one that they're probably going to be regretting down the line.
Well, I think there's a few interesting things with this. I think it shows Fox Sports One's just schizophrenia that they've shown over the years. There's been no consistent or coherent identity for this network. And if you need any indication of that, it's that Katie Nolan first appeared on Crowd Goes Wild as like the social video person or whatever. And to me, it's fascinating that they've had all these different visions for their network, from we're the ESPN alternative to we're ESPN with all the people that ESPN didn't want anymore. And there absolutely is a role for Katie Nolan there, and I think that's shown by the success that her show found on social, by all the YouTube hits it got and so on. But they still determined, we're going to put her in this late night time slot, and then we're going to be surprised when nobody actually watches it on linear TV. And I feel like it's the same story that happened with everyone else at Fox Sports One. I mean, they had this whole panel of athletes. Well, pretty much all of those guys are gone, and were gone pretty quickly. They had Jay Onright and Dan O'Toole, and they didn't really let them do what they were good at until well into their tenure. By that time,
which was a shame, by the way, because those guys were outstanding.
There's a lot of people who think they were outstanding, and who think, in particular, that the second iteration of their show was very good and was sort of the sports center alternative that people have been asking for in the first place. But it never really took off because everyone who tuned in the first time got turned off by Andy Roddick talking about the NFL. And so, I mean, it's fascinating to me that Fox has just sort of lurched from vision to vision, from identity to identity, and whoever hasn't really fit in whatever the newest model is just cast aside. And I think that's absolutely what's happened with Katie Nolan here. Now, I think something that should be said in this conversation is we did a story a little while ago on Eric Shanks, the head of Fox Sports, saying, well, I don't know why we haven't been able to find something for Katie Nolan. And I think that does imply that they did offer her some things, and they weren't able just to come to a deal with her on something that would work for her as well. But to me, that's sort of, it's a notable quote, and it shows the guy who's running Fox Sports isn't very sure of how he could use somebody like Katie Nolan. And beyond that, Katie Nolan's in a pretty good place. I mean, she's got these followers, she's got this fan base. I think things are going to work out for her at ESPN if she gets a decent opportunity there. And she didn't have to take whatever crappy offer Fox did throw at her, because there was something else out there.
I can't think of a better fit right now than Katie Nolan at Sports Nation. I mean, if Michelle Beadle goes ahead and does the morning show with Greenberg on ESPN, and there's an open spot there, I can't think of a more perfect marriage. I mean, she could go do that show and be a huge star. And I get the criticism to an extent. Well, you know, Katie Nolan didn't draw ratings at FS1. Jay and Dan didn't draw ratings. Who is drawing ratings at FS1? Now, your best show is probably still NASCAR Race Hub. So if that's just the cold, hard, pure facts, I don't understand how such and such didn't draw ratings can be a delineating factor when you're paying millions upon millions upon millions to all of these former ESPN people, and they're not really drawing ratings either. So if you're going to at least have these shows, why spend all that money for such a small pop in the ratings when you're just going to turn around and lose these big stars, or at least these well-liked individuals, to other places? To me, it's just, it doesn't make a lot of sense, but not a lot about FS1 has made sense for a good number of years now.
I think that's a strong prediction on Katie Nolan going to Sports Nation. I think that makes all the sense in the world. I think unless for some reason, and she has every right to do this because she has found her own voice, I think it could also be a situation where she would want her own project, knowing that she'd be following a very likable, very similar type of situation in ESPN, which is like, well, if I just go and I take on Sports Nation, maybe I'm just looked at as the next Michelle Beadle. I want to be known as Katie Nolan in my own regard. Maybe that's one of the things from stopping her, but I think as far as a fit, I think she'd be an outstanding fit for that show.
I totally agree. And I think that, you know, it's one of those shows that draws out a personality. We've seen it do well with Michelle Beadle. Carissa Thompson also was there for a brief period as well. And I know Michelle has said that on Dan Patrick that she feels that Carrie Champion would be a perfect fit. And she very well could be. But I think that really, if you look at it, at the personality driven program, it's really perfect for Katie Nolan. And if she wants to go out to L.A., which is where the show is based right now, and she can do a bunch of other stuff for ESPN as well, not just Sports Nation, I think that really right now the world is her oyster.
But then she wouldn't be able to hang out with Bill Simmons, and I think that would make each other sad.
Well, she is out in L.A., so that's the whole thing.
That's
you
fair.
Never know.
That's very fair. All right, guys, before we wrap up, Matt, you brought this to my attention when we were talking before the show, that there's something going on with regards to the LA Chargers, and it's starting to get some national attention.
Yeah, I dropped this bit on Shreveport Radio this morning, talking about my beloved Saints. And I even heard it on the radio here in Buckeye Country in Central Ohio. But it's just a story that is fascinating to me. It's about the Los Angeles Chargers and their struggle to attract fans, not just in the stadium, but on television at home. It all has to do with the local ratings from this past weekend for the NFL in Los Angeles. The number one rated game, Sunday night, Seahawks-Colts. The Rams were playing the Cowboys, the Dallas Cowboys, the number one ratings are on the NFL. Couldn't even get to number one in LA. So that game finished number two. Your Los Angeles Chargers, number five on television in the Los Angeles market. What did they finish behind? I'm sure everyone's waiting with bated breath. The Saints and the Dolphins in London, which was played at 6:30 a.m. local time. There were more people in Los Angeles watching an NFL game at 6:30 a.m. when I'm guessing most of the population was A, in bed, or B, probably still up from the night before. More people watching that game than there were watching Chargers-Eagles. I don't know if there's ever been a mid-season relocation in NFL history, but now may be as good a time as ever to move the Chargers back to San Diego, move them to Portland, move them to London, wherever, because it is not working in Los Angeles. When you have the visiting team trying to quiet down the fans because they're too supportive in the road stadium, I think you know you have a problem.
I don't think we can end the show any better than that. Show up, Chargers fans, wherever you may be, all 10 of you in the LA area. I appreciate all of you guys for joining me today. Ken Feng, Matt Yoder, and Andrew Buchholz joining us on this roundtable. We got our Clip It game on the other side, and fun opportunity where you guys can just listen along to the podcast. You guess who's coming up on the next episode. You have a chance to win $50 to Amazon.com. That's courtesy of our wonderful friends over at Clip It. And then make sure you stick around as Ben Koo will sit down with Herbie, Kirk Herbstreit, a little bit later on in the show. Guys, thank you so much. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast.
You're listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast, presented by Clip It. Download the Clip It app today on iOS and Android.
All right, everybody, welcome back. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast, episode 2, coming up in just a few short minutes. Ben Koo sits down with Kirk Herbstreit from ESPN and ABC. College Game Day calls the game of the week for college football. Really the quintessential college football analyst of our generation. He's terrific, and the conversation is outstanding, so you guys will really enjoy that. But before we get to that, it is time for our game of the week, where we have a guest who properly identifies this week's guest. We bring him on, have an opportunity to play a fun game with us, and today we have Jared from Alexandria, Virginia calling in. Jared, how are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm wonderful. I appreciate you joining us today. Thanks to our friends over at Clip It. We're going to have some fun with this game. And also, I don't know if you have Clip It, Jared, but it's fantastic. I actually was showing a friend of mine the app this weekend to be able to send him some of the highlights from the Indiana game, which hopefully Ben Koo will ask Kirk Herbstreit about. But I'm the lone Indiana football fan out there, so maybe that's not going to come to fruition. Anyway, I move on. The Clip It app, it is 100% free. There is zero excuse for you guys at home not to have this app to be able to share some of your favorite clips. Clips, movies, whatever it may be, the Clip It app has it. Get it today. Download it from either the Google Play Store or on your Apple device. All right, so Jared, here's how it's going to work. I have a couple clips for you. If you can properly identify both of them, you will walk away with $50 in a gift card to Amazon.com. Get just one, and it is $25. And if you miss both of them, well, we appreciate your time on the show. Very easy. Do you know how to play? Does everything make sense?
Sounds good to me.
All right, Jared, here is your first clip. I need you to identify the analyst who thought this quarterback was playing pretty well, but as we saw this week, might have cost him his job. Take a listen.
You're a Chicago Bears fan. I know you're asking for Trubisky. You're asking for that. But let me tell you something. We're here live.
Yeah.
Mike Glennon is doing his job. He's effective. He's efficient. Maybe a couple, 2 to 3 bad throws in the game. But overall, he's kept his composure. And remember, he's playing without his two best receivers. So virtually, he's out there without a dog, without a go-to guy, except for those guys coming out of the backfield.
All right, Jared, do you recognize that analyst from that Clip It clip? And if so, who was it?
Was it Chris Carter?
Oh, it was not Chris Carter. It was primetime Deion Sanders as part of the CBS NFL Network broadcast. Somehow, I don't know what game Deion Sanders was watching. Maybe he wanted to be back on the field to be able to intercept Mike Glennon, because he would have done it fairly easily, as now Mitch Trubisky is the new quarterback in Chicago. It's okay, so you still have a chance to get $25 to Amazon.com, courtesy of our friends at Clip It. And all you need to do is tell me the name of this old theme song that was played in the middle of Sunday Night Football.
Older, and he bangs it through. So 5:09 into the game. The Atlanta Falcons draw first blood, 7-0 over the Green Bay Packers.
Oh, an oldie but a goodie. I need you to name that theme song that was played on Sunday Night Football. Jared and Alexandria, do you know what that theme song was from?
I believe I do know this one. Is that a Round Ball Rock by John Tesh?
It is Round Ball Rock by John Tesh. And you even went above and beyond, man. I was just looking for the old NBA on NBC theme. But the fact that you pulled out the John Tesh Round Ball Rock card, I wish I could give you another $25 to win it all back on a double or nothing. But regardless, congratulations on your rally. $25 to Amazon.com is yours, courtesy of our friends over at Clip It. So make sure you get that app today. And Jared, I appreciate you playing with us today. Thanks so much for listening.
Thanks a lot for having me on, and I enjoy the show.
So 2 weeks and 2 winners on our Game of the Week. And on the other side, a winning conversation. Ben Koo sits down with ESPN and ABC analyst Kirk Herbstreit. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast, presented by Clip It.
Welcome back to the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Ben Heisler.
Thanks so much for listening. It is the Awful Announcing Podcast presented by our friends at Clipit. Download the Clipit app today on Android and on iOS. Earlier, Ben Koo, the fearless leader, had a great conversation with the prime analyst of ESPN's college football, Kirk Herbstreit.
One of the things I kind of wanted to get into early was kind of the evolution of college game day. I think a lot of younger fans don't realize how long it's been around. It kind of predates the, you know, kind of the heavy usage of social media and goes back way back when. So I'd be curious, you know, how did you initially get involved with ESPN and game day? What were your kind of early recollections of being pitched the show?
Man, it's been a long time. I started in 1996, and when I got out of school, I graduated from Ohio State with a business degree and looked at some pharmaceutical opportunities and just thought I'd get into maybe Worthington Industries, like at that time, a lot of Ohio State grads kind of go that path. And I put a few feelers out to some local radio stations. And at the time it was, 1460, just an AM station. And they, ironically enough, at that time of the year, they were going to an all sports format and thought it'd be great to have last year's captain of the team. Because I had showed some interest, and if they needed help in any way, let me know, and I'd love to get involved in sports talk or anything, really. And so they said, it's funny you're reaching out. We're about to go to an all-sports format in a few months and love to have you be a part of that. So I had to make – I kind of had – Ben, you probably had it. Everybody has a fork in the road, and I had a fork in the road to take more lucrative business opportunities or take a local radio station – which was going to pay me at the time $12,000 and no benefits and really no future, but it sounded fun. And I grew up listening to talk radio. And so I kind of chose that path and loved going to work every day and loved talking sports in Columbus, you know, whether it was about the Buckeyes or about the Reds or Bengals or Browns or Indians or whatever it was. And, just did that for a few years and didn't really do a whole lot of TV. We started a show, Jay Crawford and I and Dom Tiberius. It was called Wall to Wall Sports. It was on Sunday nights on Channel 10. And that was really my only TV experience at the time. I would do that with those guys. And you know, I really didn't think about my future. I really didn't. I was enjoying what I was doing. I thought I could do that for the rest of my life. And then I kept bumping into Jack Arute because I was working sideline for Ohio State Radio. And he would say, what are you doing radio? You should come work in TV. And kind of ignored him. Didn't really – I was not a big guy, big on change. So I just kind of kept doing my thing. And then he kept – every time I'd see him, it seems like Ohio State was on ABC every week. And he'd keep getting on me about it. So I decided to put a tape together. I didn't really have any TV experience. So I asked a couple of the local Channel 10 camera guys to come down to Ohio State, an empty Ohio Stadium, in February, and I did a couple fake sideline reports and thought that might look good on a tape. And then at the time, Eddie George just won the Heisman, and he and Joey Galloway were big Ohio State names, so I created a kind of a fake show called, I think we called it Buckeye Corner or something, and I just basically interviewed the two of them for about 10 minutes. Down at Channel 10, and I put that on the tape. And then I put a couple of my actual sideline reports from Ohio State Radio on the tape, and I just sent it in. And they ended up getting back to me and hired me to work on a new station at the time called ESPN2. And they said they were just getting ready to put some games on college football, and they'd love for me to be a sideline reporter for the season of 1995. And so I did. Actually, Eddie, I guess, hadn't won the Heisman yet. He was maybe leading into his Heisman year when we did that. And so 1995, I was a sideline reporter. And then next year, Craig James left. And they asked me to come in and be a part of the audition process. And they said, they literally told me, you're not going to get the job. But it'd be, as young as you are, it'd be a really good experience for you to go through it and they brought Fowler and Corso in, and I think there are maybe five or six different guys that were going to replace Craig that were kind of trying out for that spot, and I was terrified, scared to death, and sitting next to Lee Corso, I was just, like, mesmerized in the audition, and I just, you know, they gave us a few subject matters that we're going to talk about, and I prepared a little bit, and then we did it. And then when I was done, I didn't hear from them for about 4 months. This is like before the internet and emails and all that. So I eventually, they called me and said, hey, we want to offer you the job to be on College Game Day. And so those first few years that I was on the show, to your point, we would go on the road and, you know, there'd be, I don't know, 1,000 people or so around the set, and really didn't change until, ironically enough, we just went to Virginia Tech last week, and they had a player named Michael Vick at the time, and there was a lot of buzz around Virginia Tech football, and when we came there, they considered that like their opportunity to like really be kind of stamped like as they've arrived, and their head coach, Frank Beamer, challenged their fan base to show America how great their fans are. And we must have had 18,000 people show up that year in 1999 around our set. It was on their stadium floor, and they filled up the home side of their stands. And that was really the turning point for the show. I mean, from that point on, it's just been an absolute zoo, you know, wherever, depending on where we are that particular week. And something we never take for granted, never will. I always look at the crowd as like the fifth member of our set. And something that we don't sit there and look in the mirror like, hey, aren't we great? We look at, isn't college football great? Because that's the only reason we've had success. I mean, it's great that people like our show, but if we were doing this for college basketball or the NBA or NFL or MLB, we wouldn't have this kind of show. So we're not naive to think that it's us. So we're just happen to cover a great game and a very passionate sport that people love, and it's kind of a vehicle that gets people fired up in like a tailgate atmosphere every single week.
In those early years, you mentioned kind of the Virginia Tech Mike Vick days is kind of a turning point when you realized that the show had kind of become, I guess, part of the fabric of college football, and I guess going forward, it probably built from there. But in those, you know, first early years, I guess, of 96 and 97 and 98, did you guys ever go to some campuses and the crowds were thin and you had the thought, you know, is this going to be around in terms of the traveling show? Is this going to be around forever? Did you have any kind of, you know, skepticism early on that the kind of format of the traveling show with the fans in the background of, you know, all of the overhead of sending the crew somewhere and having to kind of find a new setup every week. Did you ever kind of look at the crowds and wonder if this was going to be, you know, kind of turned into the institution it would become in a few years?
Well, without knowing what the future had in store, we thought it was really epic what we were doing already. I mean, to do live TV on a college campus was unheard of at the time. So even though it wasn't what it is today, it was still really special to be on a college campus with the stadium in the backdrop or wherever we might be. And so, and again, man, I was 26, 27. You know, I don't know about you, but I didn't really think much about my future. Like I said, I loved working at WBNS. Like I loved just doing something that I enjoyed. I was so young and naive to my future. I was just happy to have a job that I loved doing. And so I guess I wasn't smart enough to even think about where is this leading or what's this going to be in 10 or 20 years. I was just like, man, I can't believe I'm on this show. This is incredible. You know, I was really more of, that was more of my approach, and that we had a guy take over ESPN named Mark Shapiro, who I would really credit for taking us to I can't remember the year, but it was in the early years. We went from kind of bouncing around and going to a lot of ABC and ESPN games And Mark Shapiro finally said, hey, if this show is going to be recognized as the sport and the show that kind of covers the sport across the board, it doesn't matter who's televising whatever game. Whoever's the game of the week, this show needs to be there. So whether it's CBS or NBC at the time, Fox really wasn't that much involved in college football back then. So whether it was NBC or CBS or ABC or whoever, we've got to go there because our fans expect our show to be at the game of the week. And man, when he did that, that was really a turning point, I think, for our show, because it showed that we're not being political. We're not just covering ESPN games. We're going to where the fans expect us to be. Now, depending on who you were a fan of over the years, do we always go to the right game? I mean, I guess that's left up to the viewer, but we do really try to make an effort to try to get to the right location. And Mark Shapiro had that vision. And like I said, I think that really changed the appreciation for the show when we went anywhere, West Coast, East Coast, Midwest, South, wherever the game of the week was. I really noticed the fans really kind of jumping on board and really appreciating that once we started to do that.
One of the kind of more fun things of College Game Day is the signs. And I was kind of curious. A lot of fans are obviously bringing in flags and signs, and they can be funny. They can be a little risque. They can troll their fan bases. I think a couple of years ago there was someone who said, hey, send me money to my Venmo account, and the kid ended up getting like a few $1,000s. And there's always kind of talk online and on social media about the signs, and yet you have your back turned to them for, you know.
Occasionally you'll come on the set and you'll see some signs. And, you know, when you're waving to the fans and kind of thanking them for coming out. But I've never really, you know, we have a segment within our show where they show kind of some of the signs of the week. And, you know, but none of them really stand out to me or stick out to me. Like, you know, I remember that one sign from that one year. You know, I remember Florida taking some shots at Florida State and Peter Warrick a long time ago, you know, about he had stolen some stuff or been accused of stealing some stuff from Dillard's. And so they went after him. I mean, you're always going to have those kind of signs, but, you know, and people from other media outlets or from, you know, they try to get some of their messages out there, you know, and one thing that's been really cool about our producer really started with Lee Fitting is, it's, you know, with the exception of cussing, we let people get whatever they want to say out there. I mean, we do have people who, when they become a little too much, you know, whether they're, you know, they're cussing or they're kind of crossing the line a little bit, I think we try to get some of those signs out. But we've gotten into some trouble because we've shown some signs that are sometimes controversial. And I think it's cool that people can come and try to express something or say something. And, you know, I think, as you know, if you, I don't know how old you are, but if you go back to when the show first started, we didn't have any signs. I mean, we had like a handful of signs and maybe the Washington State flag or something behind us. I mean, there was literally nothing behind us. And I wish I could remember when signs became such a huge thing. But now, you know, our show starts at 9 o'clock Eastern, and by the time we get to like 10:30, 10:45, you know, you turn around and look back behind you, and it's just a sea of humanity, and just those signs. I mean, there's just thousands of them, you know, that people are holding up and hoping that the cameras will catch them.
So I think the other kind of staple I think about when I think about College Game Day is Lee Corso's headgear selection. And one of the things I wanted to ask you, and maybe this is kind of a tough question or you haven't thought about, but does that tradition more or less stay with Lee Corso when he retires? Could he ever pass the baton to you to be the headgear selection person? Or can you envision anyone else doing that other than Lee?
No, I'm glad you asked that. No. When he decides it's time to step down from the show, then that that will, in my opinion, retire the headgear. I personally know I will never put the headgear on. That's his thing. That's become kind of a fabric of the sport. And people for generations now have come to expect, you know, what's he going to do this time kind of thing. And it's very, very special to him. He is an entertainer. He constantly at age 82, when we're talking in meetings, you know, he's always saying, hey, remember, you know, we're in the entertainment business. And now entertainment business for Lee Corso at age 82, who doesn't own a computer or tweets or fax, you know, he does have a fax. You know, he doesn't know entertainment today in today's media is, you know, I mean, Ben, you turn on the television right now when you and I hang up, someone's yelling at somebody on TV, you know, and it's like, you don't know if they believe what they're yelling about, but they think that that's entertaining by pounding the desk and yelling at each other. And if you've ever really watched our show, we've never done that, and we never will. Now, if I disagree with Lee or Desmond or Reese or David or whoever, then I'm going to disagree with them. But it'd be like if you and I had a discussion where you and I agreed, it's okay to agree. Or if you and I disagreed, it's okay to disagree. But we're never going to manufacture, okay, hey, you believe this and I'll believe that, and we'll really go at each other. So Lee's idea of entertaining is just little fun things. Like the other night, day we were in Louisville, and at the beginning of the show, he had the, what is it, bugle horn or whatever, and he's like started College Game Day, you know, with Churchill Downs right down the road from Louisville, and bum 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 bum, and then he slams the horn down, you know, and the show started, and it was like only Lee Corso can do that, and he had a silly hat on, and it was just, that's his vision of entertainment. Or at the end of the show, you know, you kind of know what's coming, but it's still fun to watch what's he up to this week. That's his version of entertainment. And so one thing I love about our show, and it'll never change, is you can watch our show and you're going to get some football. I mean, I'll break down X's for you. David Pollack, you know, we'll break it down. You're going to cry. You know, you're going to watch Tom Rinaldi and you're probably going to cry, or Gene. And then you're going to watch hopefully a lot of fun, lighthearted moments with Lee and myself and the rest of the guys. And so it's kind of a mixed bag of, it's not just football, 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 football. You know, I think if we did that, we would bore people to tears. And he still to this day is the guy that's always just like keeping us honest on, hey guys, we're getting a little bit away from who we are. And so, yeah, I mean, that's a long answer to your question about the headgear. Lee Corso is the headgear. And as far as I'm concerned, no matter who steps in when he is done, nobody's ever allowed to wear the headgear. I think that's his thing.
Now, you asked me, or you mentioned earlier, I don't know how old, you know, I am. And so the answer there is I'm a 2006 Ohio State grad. And
oh, cool.
I actually grew up on the West Coast, and obviously you kind of know, because of the time difference, game days and kind of the institution it is out here to some degree as it is out you know, the Midwest and the East Coast. And I remember learning about game day early on in college, and I have all these fond memories of going to home games and away games, and especially those noon kickoff games.
Yep.
And I was always punctual. Like, I wanted to be there for kickoff, but if Ohio State's playing, you know, Indiana at home, potentially, you know, stragglers would come in at the end of the first quarter. But I remember wherever right. I would go for a game, when the stragglers would come, they would be like, hey, who did Corso pick for
right,
this game?
Right.
And people would always like, oh, you know what, Corso picked Michigan to beat Ohio State. And then, you know, like whenever people showed up late, that was the morsel of information from like the tailgate or like college
That's
party
so funny.
That
yeah.
people wanted to get from the people being late. It wasn't like, I can't believe you missed kickoff. It'd be like, what course are you?
That's hilarious. That's funny. And congratulations, by the way, on being there in 06. That was a magical year. Jeez.
Yeah, I, you know, got to go
too far down the Buckeye road, but, you know, I was there for the Miami National Championship, and one of the things I kind of take a lot of pride in was I was the organizer of our group of, like, the road trips. So I'm one of, I got to imagine, a few Buckeyes who are not associated with the team who went to the last four games that year of Holy Buckeye, Illinois overtime, Michigan at home, and then
oh my God,
Miami. And it's like I'm, you know, I don't even think I was of drinking age at that point, just out there having the time of my life going to those games.
People forget that year, that Illinois game. I mean, everybody remembers Holy Buckeye, but the Illinois game was terrifying. They're throwing fades. I think it was against Dustin Fox, and they had a really tall receiver. It was just grueling to watch that. And you know, I think it was dark. I think it was, you know, it was when they kicked it 3:30, and the clocks had already been set back, so the whole second half was dark, and the lighting wasn't the greatest. And you're just like, oh my gosh, that was a stressful game for really, like you said, a whole stretch. There were about four or five of those games that were pretty stressful that year.
Yeah, I think that season's actually like changed my disposition towards sports, where normally I would be very cynical about any team, you know, it could be my baseball team or my NFL team's chances to win it all. But I always be like, no, it happened in 02. You just gotta just believe, even though it's gonna look terrible the whole time, you have a ominous feeling like it can happen, even though, you know, it doesn't seem like it's going to happen. I think it's really, even my disposition on life, I feel like that team like rubbed off like this sense of like, don't worry, it does happen sometimes.
Wow, that's pretty powerful, because I'm a glass half empty guy myself. I am a big time reverse psychology guy when it comes to following my teams, and then when it's something good happens, it's more of, oh my gosh, this is great, you know.
Well, I would say that the glass half full for me just stays within sports. Everything else, it's almost empty.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you.
So I guess, you know, I had a couple questions about Lee Corso. I know you have a lot of affection for him, and that's kind of been a great part of game day, and you know, it's been a big part of your life. I guess I would ask, mm-hmm. you know, do you have a favorite on-air moment with him? Was it him dropping an F-bomb? Is it you know, when he fired a gun? I mean, what's something that you kind of like, maybe in the wee hours of the night, will like look up on YouTube to kind of crack a smile?
Well, the obvious one is when he dropped the F-bomb. I mean, it was almost like, well, he finally did it, you know, kind of thing. And the reaction, I've never seen a guy say what he said on air and his status go up. You know, I mean, it's like, that day I had to fly to Eugene, Oregon, cause game day was at Houston, and the game I was calling was USC at Oregon. And so I got onto a plane and flew up there. As soon as I landed, in Eugene, Phil Knight's plane had just landed, and so when I was walking out to the car on the curb there at the airport, he had a huge RV that was decked out and out there, and he saw me about to get in the car, and he ran off of his RV and came over and hugged me and high-fived me and said, man, that Corso is absolutely crazy, man. He wanted to hear the whole story on how it happened, and then I thought that was funny, and then we were driving up into the stadium, and a lot of times I go on the field if I get there early enough before the game just to talk to the coaches the last few minutes before the game starts. And Chip Kelly sees me, and I'm about at the opposite 20, and he's at about the other 20, and he sees me, and we kind of wave, and he full sprint starts running to me. I mean, he full sprint 60, 70 yards, and he high-fives me. Man, he's my hero. Corso's my man, you know. And Lane Kiffin, who was the head coach at the time, he does the same thing. And I was just like, it was so funny. And then the next week, anybody I bumped into, all they wanted to do was talk about Lee and what happened. I can't believe he did that. And so that's the one that definitely comes to mind. But, man, I have to tell you, it's weekly with what he does and, you know, some of the things that he says. And it's just approach to life. I don't know if you've ever been around him or whenever game day's been in Columbus, but if you haven't, you should come around next time we're there. I mean, he is just talking about the glass half full or half empty. He is overflowing full. Like, he's just one of those guys, just never met a stranger, you know, that guy, and just full of life and always there for you. That's why I think, you know, what I can't tell you how many people say to me, especially older folks will say, I really thank you for how you treat Coach and how you take care of him. And I'm just like, if you knew him, you would do the same thing. I mean, it's just, he just happened to be my buddy and guy that I've been sitting with for 22 years. But it's one thing on air, but our real relationship would be off air, where I talk to him like he's like my dad, really. I mean, I ask him things and talk to him, and he gives you advice about stuff in your personal life, about raising kids. And anytime you're going through a stressful moment, he's a really good guy to talk to, and probably like anybody else out there, that when you have somebody that really listens and really gives you some really good advice, he's like a Yoda, you start to naturally become a lot closer, you know, as just friends. And hopefully he feels that way about me. I think he does, you know. And I don't know, it's the on-air stuff is fun, like him dropping the F-bomb. Some of the one-liners he has said over the years are great. But the reason I think you see me the way I am towards him is just because of the personal relationship that he and I have.
So I'm someone who gets very stressed when they travel, and you have some of the more interesting kind of travel wrinkles that is out there in sports media, where, you know, a handful of times a year you'll do game day in the morning, or at least the morning out here, and then you have to travel to the game, you know, that you'll be calling at night on ABC. What's the closest you've ever had to, you know, potentially being late for a kickoff? And behind the scenes for some of these games, is there ever like a contingency plan in place in case something goes, you know, awry?
I guess the answer to your second question is no. They've always just hoped I would make it. We've never really had that put in place. It's never really been a close call. I've been doing this since 06. There's only one game where it was a little bit of a concern, and we were actually, again, out in Eugene, Oregon, and flying to Boston, and there was a nor'easter that was coming into that area, and it was really messy. And so while we were flying, the weather got really bad, and they had to try to avoid some storms, and ended up landing at a different airport than where we were initially assigned to land. And so we had to make a lot of different accommodations as far as the vehicle that was there to try to help us, pick us up, and get us to BC. Notre Dame was playing Boston College, and I think we pulled up. The game was at 8 o'clock Eastern, and I think we literally got to the stadium, and it was a monsoon. I'm talking windshield wipers as fast as they can go, and you still can't see. And we pulled into the stadium about 7:30, between 7:30 and 7:45.
Oh, wow.
And I just went, yeah, straight upstairs. And you know, that was the only time, knock on wood, but that was the only time that we've ever had a really close situation. Everything else has worked out pretty well. But no, they don't have a contingency plan. So I don't know what they would do if I didn't make it.
When you are flying for those weeks that you have to travel to games, are you able to watch other games or follow other games online, or are you studying, or is it kind of like, hey, I just had to be kind of on more or less for game day, and now I have to be on later, I'm going to try to get in a couple hours of Z's? Like, what's your routine that you try to get into when you're kind of in between those two, you know, bookends of your day?
Yeah, it's, again, a great question. There's two different ways of doing that. There's the weeks where game day and the game I'm calling are in the same spot. And in that case, you know, you get through game day, and then we tape a segment after game day, and then we take a bunch of pictures. And then so my whole entire mission is to get to our bus, because we have five TVs in the back of that bus. And for me, that is the best time of the entire week, is to watch games. We got five TVs.
In that.
I mean, it's heaven, right? I mean, it's like five TVs. The room is cold. It's dark. We've got food. and do my tie, and I've got my board for the game I'm calling that night with all my notes on it, kind of sitting on my lap. But me and Felica and Darren Brown, who's a friend of mine, who's my spotter, went to Ohio State. We're just sitting on there just yelling at the TVs like you and everybody else does, and making, hey, look over here, screen two, you know, oh, oh, look over here, screen four. You know, we're just yelling at the games just like fans do. And we do that until 7 o'clock when I got to go out to the field for whatever game that I'm covering. And, you know, I go out, like I said earlier, talk with some coaches and players before I go up into the booth at about 7:30. So that's kind of the routine whenever I'm in the same spot. And then whenever we leave, so you finish game day, immediately we go straight to a car. We go right to an FBO. We go up into the air. While we're in the air, with Wi-Fi, you're able to kind of monitor all the different games. And between Felica and I, we're yelling out scores and yelling out heads third and eight, you know, whatever's going on. We kind of become play-by-play guys for all the games. And then usually it's about a two-hour flight, most cases, wherever we're going. And then we, you know, as soon as we land, and I'm not just saying this, it's the reality. I mean, I turn on the ESPN app so I can turn on whatever games are on that ESPN family and network. So usually some games that you want to watch. And so we fire that thing up and then get over to the stadium, and our bus is there at the stadium. So as soon as we get there, we get back in the back of the bus with those five TVs and get them going, and kind of business as usual once we arrive on site. And then the rest of it would just apply, like if we were if the game and game day were in the same place.
So this is probably a question I would imagine you may have not been asked before, but you know, let's say at the end of your current contract, you know, you spoke with John Skipper, presuming he's still the president of ESPN, and you said, you know, this double duty on Saturdays, it's a bit much. I'm thinking about, you know, only doing one gig. And if he says, well, I'll pay you, you know, the same money to either or, I'll let you pick, would you have more of an attachment to kind of continue doing game day, or would you kind of prefer to keep calling the ABC and the national championship games and all those big assignments? You know, do you kind of prefer the play-by-play, or do you like being intermixed in the fans, on campuses? You know, what's if you ever got to a point where you were going to throttle it down and it was one or the other, which way would you lean? And also, which is your favorite kid?
Exactly. So true. That is the greatest thing about my job, is I get to do both. I've never really gone there. I mean, I have talked with my wife a little bit about, like, what about down the road, what I might do, you know, but I've never really, like, really thought about having to make that choice. And the way you just put that, you know, I love game day because I love having opinions on teams and conferences all around the country, and I love that fans tune in to watch that show, and I love helping shape opinions and people disagreeing and agreeing, and just, yeah, I love to be in the middle of the conversation for some of the big subjects. So I love that about game day. I love the guys I work with on the show. So it's really hard for me to imagine not doing that. But at the same time, I really, really, really love calling the games of the week, and especially at the end of the year when the games get bigger and then you get into the playoffs, mm-hmm. and national championships. So, man, I just have no idea which one that I would pick. I mean, my contract goes for another 7 years, so I guess at that point I couldn't imagine not calling the games. So I guess if down the road, I guess maybe I would just call the games, kind of like what Fowler has done at this stage of his career, where he's just doing the games and tennis. But that's not my goal at all. I don't want to come across like that's where I'm headed, because that's really not my goal. But if you're asking me which one would I, you know, 7 years from now, if I could only do one, I guess I would lean towards just calling the game.
You mentioned earlier you like kind of the discussions that college game day generates, and I thought I'd kind of pivot to some general college football stuff if you had a few more minutes. So, you know, college football fans are kind of never happy. They always think their team's kind of getting screwed by the current system. What are your thoughts on where we are right now with the four-team playoff? Would you like to see it switched? You know, I know a lot of people are keen on eight. I've kind of thought six with the first two seeds having a bye would be kind of interesting. You know, what are your thoughts on where we are right now in terms of the playoff format?
I kind of like four. I wouldn't be opposed to six. I think eight starts to water it down a little bit. I think it doesn't make a lot of sense to have five Power Five conferences and then to leave one of them out every year. So I wouldn't have a problem with six. And, you know, I've never really thought about it, but if you did the five, the Power Five, and then if you wanted to throw in one, the highest ranked from the group of five, that could be your answer right there. So I wouldn't have an issue with that. How you work that out, you know, I think sometimes people forget about the NFL playoffs and, you know, what day of the week do you play it and all that stuff. But I've really enjoyed getting away from just two. I think that's been great. And I think sometimes people forget, you might not have remembered this, but you know, when you go way back to the Bull Coalition, the Big Ten and the Pac-10 at the time, now the Pac-12, they were left out. So if you had an undefeated Ohio State or an undefeated Michigan and an undefeated USC or an undefeated Washington, and you had an undefeated Miami of Florida or an undefeated Florida State, they didn't play each other in a Fiesta Bowl. The Big Ten was kind of left out of those situations, and same with the Pac-10. So at least the BCS got everybody into the same pool, which I thought was a huge step in the right direction. So I, as much as people pour mouth the BCS, I love that aspect of it. I just wasn't a big fan of the computers. I didn't like that part of it. And a lot of times the pollsters, when you went back and really researched it, you almost wondered, did they really even watch the games? Because did they take, you know, their job seriously as a pollster. It's okay to disagree, but when you have a team that's clearly shouldn't be ranked where they are and they are, you're like, wow, I don't know if this guy's really watching the game. So I was happy to see, I like the committee. I like the idea of it. I like how serious they take their job, whether you agree or disagree with them. I think that they're trying their best and really working it, trying to get the right teams in. But Ben, I think where the fans are confused, because I think the media is confused too, is are you trying to put the four most deserving teams into the playoff, or are you trying to put the four best teams into the playoff? And that's why last year with Penn State beating Ohio State and going to the Big Ten Championship and still being left out, the thing that I think a lot of people struggled to understand was the committee collectively felt Ohio State, again, you may disagree, but Ohio State was a better team despite that loss, and their goal is to put the four best teams into the playoff. And so if we go to six or it eventually goes to eight, we're still going to have these frustrations. We're still going to have people that are not agreeing with, you know, why is this team left out? Why is this team put in? So, and I think, by the way, I think there's really nothing wrong with that. I think it just shows you, again, some of the passion that's around the sport that I don't think the NFL or any of these other sports really have. So I'm good with the committee being in charge of this, but I'd have no problem if they moved it up to six. And even eight, I'd be okay, but I'd prefer four and six sound better to me than eight.
All right, well, let me pitch you on another alternative that I wrote about a year ago. Around the week of the championship games, I kind of looked at the history of those games, and you actually have a lot of lopsided games, whether it's Alabama beating up whoever's, you know, the representative in, you know, the other side of the SEC, You have the ACC with Florida State and Clemson. The North as basically being the south of the Pac-12, I believe, every year. These conference championships haven't really been that competitive, and it's always been tilted towards one region. What would your thoughts be on if we scrapped them entirely and just went to the eight-game playoff?
And you're saying go straight to an eight-team playoff?
Yeah, eight-team playoff, and then just without the conference championship games because they've been, you know, lackluster to a certain degree.
Yeah, they have been. Sometimes they end up, like last year's Big Ten championship game was great. The Big Ten championship, more often than not, can deliver a pretty competitive game.
Uh-huh.
But some of the others have not. The thing that I think has been maddening for me with the conference championships is that, and finally the Big 12 is getting involved this year, but forever the Big 10 did not have one. The SEC had one. The Big 12 had one. And nobody, a lot of the other conferences did not. And it's like, why, everybody should be on the same playing field as opposed to some in, some out. Now everybody's finally in. I don't know. I'm still a guy that likes, the conference championship game. And I know it's, you know, people say it's made for TV. There's something about that last weekend where you've already accomplished a lot, and in Ohio State's case or Michigan's case, whoever, you know, they played in that game, and now you got one more game to play. You know, in Florida's case, they'll play Florida State, you know, and then they've got to a lot of times get ready for an SEC championship game. So everybody kind of has a different story on what they have to overcome to get ready to play in that championship game. But I like the games. I mean, I go back, you can think about some moments when Texas played Nebraska going way back. I can't remember what year that was. It was in the 90s, but there have been some really great moments that I think are fun, and I think the fans enjoy them. But you could, everything I'm saying, you could also make a case the other way about how they're a waste. We really don't need them. What's the point? But I'm just saying as a fan, just a fan in me, I like watching those games, you know, and I like that there's something at stake for those teams that are trying to get over that last hurdle before they end up getting into the playoff.
So this last weekend, I would say probably the most exciting game, or maybe the game with the most kind of impact to the national championship picture, was USC and Washington State. And I'm out on the West Coast, but I'm actually moving east in a couple months. And that game, I was with some friends, and it was ending around like 11:30. And my friend said, this is crazy. Does this normally happen that games end this late? And I said, you know, when I move to the East Coast, it's going to be like last call, and it's going to be like 8 minutes
left
in the fourth quarter. And I kind of wanted to get your thoughts on just Friday night football in general. The Big Ten has gone that route now. You know, the Pac-12 gets these, you know, odd time kickoffs from like kind of a national perspective, and the high school coaches, you know, in the Big Ten region have kind of pushed back there. You know, obviously you're at ESPN and they have kind of an interest here, but, you know, is that something you'd like to see potentially avoided with kind of these odd kickoff times with really relevant national games going, or is that just kind of like, it is what it is. This is the business we're in. We need those kind of television windows, you know, to generate the money for these athletic departments.
I'm the wrong guy to ask because I grew up in Ohio, and Ohio high school football is in my blood. And Friday nights for forever high school football for me. It's Friday Night Lights. It's little towns, in my case, in little corners of the state of Ohio, that everybody, the town shuts down, and that's where everybody goes to listen to the high school band, and you can smell popcorn in the air, and it's just like, here come the teams through the big sign, they break through the sign. It matters a lot to people. So I'm the wrong guy on that. I mean, I love college football. I love when they have games on. I watch, you know, if there's a game on a Wednesday, I'm that guy. But like you, it sounds like, Ben, I'm that guy watching Northern Illinois play, you know, Ohio or whoever is playing. So I watch them,
but I'm not a fan of it. I think Friday night is sacred. I think it's for high school football. I'll always kind of feel that way. And I'll probably, as soon as I'm done and retired from this, the biggest thing that I miss is watching high school football on Friday nights and, being around that atmosphere. For me, college football is the best. High school football is right beneath that. And then, there's a pretty good drop and then NFL football for me after that. So, but again, I didn't grow up in California. I didn't grow up in wherever. I know people like high school football, but you grew up in Ohio, man. It's just
more people came to see the band at my high school than.
That's what I was going to say. Like in Ohio, I mean, I don't know if you got a chance when you lived in Ohio as a student.
I went to a Maslin game. I saw the documentary about Maslin football, and I had a friend who went there, and he took me.
Yeah.
And they had the 4-story inflatable tiger, and then they had like a cub tiger on the field, and I had to get in, which was, totally different.
But it's just the tradition of it. You know, it's like, to this day, I'm 48, and I get an update every single Friday night about my high school team and from buddies of mine that still live back there. And, you know, we just upset Wayne last week, who has a bunch of Division I kids on their team, and we have our new head coach who's trying to bring our tradition back to Centerville, where I went to school, AJ Hawk, Mike Nugent, a bunch of guys, and we're all very proud of that program. And like I said, I'm 48, still getting updates about how the high school football team's doing. So, and I'm not, Polk High, like living in 1988. It's not like that. You're just proud of what that that program stands for, and love to see kids from new generations get the experience what you experienced. So yeah, I'm a huge fan of high school football, and think that Friday nights belong to them.
So I don't want to keep you too long, but I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you some thoughts on just this season in general, if you still have a few minutes.
Sure.
So I guess, with the Heisman, a lot of people are beginning to think that Saquon Barkley really has kind of a large lead here, and I guess maybe Baker Mayfield's in that discussion. Is there anyone off the radar now that you could see kind of making a late season push to, potentially be kind of a dark horse winner of the Heisman?
Well, in August, I got asked that question, and I said Kenny Hill from TCU. I thought TCU at the beginning of the year, I picked them to win the Big 12, and still feel that they have a chance to be a surprise team. They got over one hurdle against Oklahoma State, and I think there's still a chance that they could emerge, even though everybody's expecting Baker Mayfield in Oklahoma. I think Kenny Hill could be a guy, and TCU could be a team to look out for in the coming weeks. And the other guy might be Bryce Love. I don't know. Sometimes you've lived it. Sometimes it's hard for guys on the West Coast, for people, because let's face it, I mean, he went for 300 yards last week. And if you asked a fan of the Big Ten or the SEC or the ACC, hey, tell me about Bryce Love. Excuse me? Like they just don't, they don't know. They don't see it. They don't hear about it. You have to be a lunatic about the sport if you live east of the Rockies to know about Pac-12 football. And it's because of what you were talking about earlier. These games, they start at 10 o'clock Eastern, and a lot of people, they're fans of teams that started at noon or at 3:30, and they just don't have the time or the interest maybe in following it. But I do, and I know what kind of year he's having. I know the offense that he's a part of, and I know the big games that he still has coming up. So he definitely, I don't know if he's going to get the attention that he should, but if they keep winning, I know I'll beat his drum and definitely talk about him. But those would be two names that might be a little bit off the beaten path besides the obvious names. I think Saquon Barkley is as good a player with the ball in his hands that I've seen personally since probably Reggie Bush when he was at USC. I can't think of another guy, and there's been some great ones, but he literally makes you hold your breath because you don't know what he's going to do. And, he seems to have a pretty level head, and think about the opportunities that he still has in the windows of games against obviously Ohio State and Michigan, and then if they keep going, maybe he gets a chance in the Big Ten championship game. So I think he is at a different category. I think at a different level, and I think there's a drop, and then I think there's Baker Mayfield because of his performance against Ohio State mainly, and then I think there's a drop, and then I think there's, you know, the other candidates that you want to bring up. At least, again, after a month of football, it could change, but that's where we are right now for me.
So after a month of football, what conference do you think is going to be the one left out? We talked earlier about how there's five conferences, four spots, and this always leads to sour grapes. Who's going to be that conference this year who's like, oh, we should be at eight. I can't believe it. This system's great.
Yeah. Well, I think we have to assume that the ACC and the SEC look like they're in pretty good shape as we sit here again right now with Clemson and Alabama. And even Miami. I don't know if you saw Miami play Duke. Man, Mark Richt's doing a heck of a job with them. Their defense looked great. And Georgia, I should have mentioned them too, with Georgia and Alabama and Auburn. So the SEC and the ACC, I think, will be in there. It just comes down to, will the Big Ten beat each other up and not have anybody left? I don't know. I think Michigan's capable of playing with Penn State and Ohio State. Whether or not they'll beat them, I don't know. Wisconsin looks to be on a path of being able to get to Indy, more than likely undefeated. I know they have Michigan, but they get them at home. So we'll see. It's hard to imagine the Big Ten not being in the playoff. So if you look at them, it seems like this debate always comes down to the Big 12 and the Pac-12. And with USC right now, again, well, last year they were 1-3 and everybody wrote them off. And by the end of the year, they were one of the best teams in the country. But as we sit here right now, Washington and Washington State are sitting out there. You assume that they're going to play maybe a USC. The Big 12, people that don't follow this may not realize they don't have an East and a West or a North and a South. They just have their teams, and then the top two will play each other. You imagine being, let's say, Oklahoma, and you've already beaten, let's say, TCU or Oklahoma State, and now you have to play them again in the championship game. So, you know, that's a tough thing to ask a team to do. The Big 12 could beat each other up and knock each other out. So I think it'll come down to the Big 12 and the Pac-12 fighting to find out, you know, if a Washington – or an Oklahoma or a TCU ends up getting in there. But it's going to be a nasty debate, I think even worse this year than it's ever been before.
Oh, God. that's
I know.
A prediction. when do you think we might get two teams in a four-team playoff? Do you think that'll ever happen, or do you think the committee is going to try to steer away from that scenario as hard as possible, and, you know, it's just going to be total toxicity and disarray for college football fans if we ever got into a scenario where the SEC or the ACC or the Big Ten had two teams in there. Do you think that could happen? And, you know, if it would, what would be the conference down the road you think could potentially steer to that outcome?
Wow, I just don't see it happening because of the committee feeling that they need to be politically correct. They already take so much grief. You imagine if they put Ohio State and Penn State in last year, what kind of feedback they would have gotten from the rest of the country.
It'd be rough.
So I don't think they'll go there. But I do think it would probably, as we sit here right now, be the Big Ten, just because of when you have Ohio State and Michigan and Penn State all in the same division. And I think that's different than when you have, let's say, an Alabama on one side and like a Georgia on the other. And I know Auburn sometimes can get up there with Alabama, but they play them at the end of the year, and sometimes that can hurt you as well. So I don't know. I don't ever see it happening, but if it did, it would probably favor the teams in these conferences where they have two or three powerhouses in one side of their conference.
All right, so my last question for you is, do you think we've kind of reached an era of parity within college football with the conferences? I feel like we went through the stretch with the SEC's dominance where this was like a sticking point for every fan. Was their conference pride in trying to either reclaim it or improve on others that, you know, their conference was the best? I have some odd stories of traveling south and wearing some Buckeye gear and just, you know, not having the funnest of times. And I thought kind of led to a lot of, you know, how the media covered college football and how the fans kind of acted when, you know, kind of mingled out there with other fans. Do you think we've kind of reached the point with, you know, the ACC winning some national championships, Ohio State, you know, has that kind of gone away? And is it maybe kind of good for the sport that we're in this era of parity after what I thought was a little bit of a toxic period where it was, you know, fans weren't really enjoying the sport as much as they could be when they were with fans of another conference?
Yeah, I still think it's ugly out there. I mean, I still think if you wear, for certain teams, I still think if you wear an Ohio State sweatshirt in certain regions of the country, you're still going to get a lot of grief. Same probably if you wore a Michigan sweatshirt, just like if you wore an Alabama sweatshirt. So I still think that part of it's out there, but I definitely think there's more parity. I mean, there for a while from 06 till whatever year it was, it seems to be, what was it, 7 or 8 years, the SEC had the upper hand. And to be fair, they top to bottom, they were a great conference, and everybody else was catching up to them. And I think to the credit of the Big Ten and the ACC, they've made some incredible hires. And when you make great hires, you're going to, recruiting is going to change, and you're going to get better athletes, and you're going to raise the bar for your entire conference. And I think that's happened, especially in the Big Ten. I mean, everybody talks about James Franklin and Jim Harbaugh and obviously Urban Meyer, but I think Paul Christ is a great fit at Wisconsin. You know, I think we're starting to see a little bit of already some dividends from Jeff Brohm at Purdue. You know, Pat Fitzgerald and Kirk Ferentz, they're very stable with what they do at their schools. Mark D'Antonio, even though they're kind of down, I mean, there for a while, they had three back-to-back-to-back mm-hmm. years. I would argue maybe the best in school history. And, you know, I know it's more of a challenge for him now with Harbaugh there and Urban doing what he's doing. DJ Durkin at Maryland and what he's got going. So I think when you hire great people, you're gonna really help your brand. And I think the Pac-12 is better. I even know people, again, maybe on the East Coast and other regions don't maybe understand that. I feel like sometimes I have to defend the Pac-12 more than any other conference when I talk to people from the SEC or the ACC. And, you know, even when Chip Kelly had them rolling, people just did not respect the Pac-12. And I think if you're a Pac-12 fan, the best thing that can happen is, whether it's non-conference play or bowl games, whatever school from the Pac-12 goes out and competes against the Big Ten or the ACC or the SEC and the Big 12, they got to hope they do well and, mm-hmm. and show that they can play in those games, because that's the only way you can change your perception of your conference. But I think we're in a really good place, because I do think it's much, much more even, and there's definitely more parity than where we were, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years ago.
Well, thank you, Kirk. You've been very giving with your time. Behind the scenes, this came together quickly, and we went a little bit over time, but I'm glad we had him on. You can find Kirk Saturday mornings on College Game Day. If you're on the West Coast, maybe you can DVR it, because it's for some people who may have gone out on Friday night, it's not everyone's cup of tea to get up that early to watch a pregame show. But if not, you can catch them Saturday nights on ABC doing all the big games for the rest of the season. Kirk, thanks for coming on. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, glad to be with you. You guys keep up the great work. I'm a big fan of your guys' work as well. So look forward to catching up with you down the road.
Great stuff from ESPN College Football Analyst Kirk Herbstreit with our own Ben Koo. Big thanks to him. Big thanks to our friends over at Clipit for help making this podcast possible, as well as to our great roundtable of Matt Yoder, Ken Fang, and Andrew Buckholz. We'll be back in a few weeks, hopefully. Until then, my name is Ben Heisler. Make sure you give Awful Announcing a follow as well at Awful Announcing on Twitter, and be sure to read the latest and greatest over at awfulannouncing.com. We'll talk to you again soon. Take care.